You have taken on quite a responsibility, Data.
To prepare, I have scanned all available literature on parenting. There seems to be much confusion on this issue. One traditional doctrine insists, spare the rod and spoil the child, suggesting a punitive approach, while another more liberal attitude would allow the child enormous freedom.
Data.
And what Klingons do to their children.
Data, I am not talking about parenting. I am talking about the extraordinary consequences of creating a new life.
Does that not describe becoming a parent, sir?
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, eating poison berries and learning deep, deep lessons about fraternal love.
And now for this week's conundrum, the evolution of androids.
Yeah, Cam, androids have been around Star Trek since the very beginning.
Star Trek or science fiction?
Well, I think this is a Star Trek podcast, so let's talk about that there. So anyways, androids, they've been around Star Trek since the very beginning. And I think they kind of represent something that I think Gene Roddenberry has always been intrigued by, but kind of that God issue, you know, what makes a creator, and can the creator ever be... I guess, overcome to a certain degree. And it is fascinating because there is this kind of uncanny valley complex that has to do with androids. And they address this, as you said before, in a lot of science fiction movies to varying degrees.
Like, including Forbidden Planet, which heavily inspired, you know, Star Trek. And you see seeds of that movie in, for example, an episode we're going to talk about later, Requiem for Methuselah.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, it's been part and parcel of science fiction for a long time. And Star Trek, groundbreaking stuff with androids. I don't know, if they invented the entire deal. As you said, you know, they've been around for a while. But I think they do some very intriguing things that we haven't really seen in other sci-fi things before. And I think just even the whole Data issue, and believe us, we will be getting to Data throughout this. We're going to start off, you know, chronologically, but we've got a lot to say with regards to Data and maybe where androids go from here in the Star Trek universe, which I think also ties back to Data with the whole Star Trek Picard stuff that's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, also, Isaac Asimov was a friend of Roddenberry's. He was showing up at the first Star Trek convention. So, like, Roddenberry was fascinated with what the future could hold for artificial intelligence. And yeah, maybe he wasn't the originator of these ideas, but you can really see how he channeled them into the Star Trek idea. I think a lot of it really has to do, too, with, like, Roddenberry was fascinated with the idea of humanity. And we have Spock on the original series, always striving to kind of bridge the gap in some way between, you know, your human Kirk and who he was. And the show loved to examine that. And so when you bring on androids, it's another way of doing that same thing.
Well, wasn't Spock even supposed to have, like, mechanical stomach, you know, on him?
Yeah,
like that kind of weird stuff?
Yeah, so, where he ate through, like, a plate in his stomach.
You know, don't know the logistics of that, but I'm intrigued, nonetheless.
They saved that for the Picard spinoff.
Can't wait, yeah. Those aren't Romulans that we're seeing. It's plated Martians.
Tummy tasters.
Tummy tasters, I like that. That's the new name of our podcast. Anyways, let's kick it off very early on with what little girls are made of here. We have Dr. Christoph Waltz. No, I mean, sorry, Dr. Corby here on this planet. And long-lost dude, it's actually one, Nurse Chapel's ex-fiancé.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that he was Nurse Chapel's ex-fiancé.
But we get down to this planet, and we do find out that there be androids here. And Cam, I think we touch on a common theme, at least during the TOS run of androids very early on, which, if we think about how women are portrayed as androids, it is the way to objectify them in a very, very literal sense.
Yeah.
And there's some disturbing threads that we keep coming across here.
Yeah.
But essentially, it just, they're even described as mechanical geisha.
Yes.
And it's like, wow.
Yeah. Okay. And it's like, that's in Forbidden Planet as well. Like, this trope of these old male scientists having the, you know, beautiful female android goes way back, but it's something Star Trek really doubles down on when they're doing androids in the original series.
And I go back to the whole creator complex that we're talking about here, but if you are a god, if you can create anything in the world, we find that Star Trek says, well, obviously you would create sex bots.
Right.
And it's like, it is telling that's the story that they want to go time and time again, at least in the original series. And it is... I think there's some missed opportunities here to go even deeper into some things that maybe that's what they actually touch on in, say, Next Generation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously they weren't really doing that in Next Generation, but they kind of exhausted themselves down that avenue in the original series. This episode's interesting in that it does feel like it's delving into the idea of androids in a way that maybe something before Star Trek might not have. They would have done it much more superficially and not actually been interested in delving into how an android operates. Because, yes, you have Kirk with this Andrea robot using the Kirk sexy magic, if you will, you know, forcing her to kiss him. And then that is disrupting her mechanical circuits because she can't process this sort of desire. It's absurd. I mean, I'm sure William Shatner, the actor, was like, boy, this is a testament to how great I am back in 1966. But yeah, like, it's goofy, but I can at least look at it and say, like, I appreciate that they're trying to examine the science of what would happen with an android dealing with emotion that it can't process. Like, I guess that in itself is what, and this isn't like one of my favorite episodes of the original series by any stretch of the first season, especially, but
how come you're wearing Andrea's outfit right now?
It's summer, man.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
The only thing is tan lines on this thing, I tell you.
It's a little weird.
Yeah. But yeah, like, I can kind of appreciate it for that because I think if you were to look at most 60s science fiction stories going on at this point, they would have been a little more fantasy space opera stuff that wouldn't necessarily be interested in trying to tackle something like that, even though it comes across now as pretty weird.
Now, beyond the objectification of women and the literal sense of, you know, stamping them down as your own property, there are some interesting things going on here. One of the things I kept going back to is, like, Rock, he's that very distinct looking bot that is kind of the enforcer the entire time.
Yeah.
I'm kind of intrigued by exactly how advanced he is. We know that he's like thousands of years old.
Yeah.
And maybe his capacity for learning hit a ceiling at a certain point. I'm not quite sure I buy his memories fading. I don't think that's how computers work exactly because he's so old. But I was kind of
intrigued. Remember, this is 1966 writers writing about computers.
Well, remember, like, when we did get a look at the computers, like, they're like string holding them together, which is interesting. So, like, I'm kind of intrigued by kind of these ideas here and what it really means to be kind of somebody in the shape of man trying to protect or make your home world kind of persist, you know, as he noted, well, you organics kind of screwed things up, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. And it seems as if you have the capacity to do that still. So it is interesting to see him as kind of an antagonist that we can kind of come around and sympathize to by the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I do like the idea of Corby, who was basically killed on this planet and managed to put his consciousness into this new machine, and how it does become a perversion of himself. It is essentially underlining how,
for anyone who doesn't remember, like, we do find out that the Corby we've been interacting with is in fact an android.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I like the idea that, you know, the show is underlining that, you know, humanity is very definable by the body we're within, at least at this point in Star Trek. And so the idea of him putting it into this new machine body, it seems like it's there, you know, in superficial details, but ultimately whatever was human about him is gone now.
Well, that's a question I wanted to ask you. Like, how much, or do you really believe it's his full consciousness that was transferred to this android?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's enough to sell the idea of him to Kirk and Chapel, at least initially, but ultimately it is a hollow shell.
So his brain waves, you know, they can kind of do the calculations, but beyond that, it's just more of a facsimile to the limits of this computer system, like recreating who he was.
And these don't seem also like the greatest androids we're going to see on Star Trek. Like, they seem a little more limited.
Sure, yeah.
So it definitely makes sense that he isn't completely sold as being the genuine article. It's interesting, the Kirk one seems more so to trick the crew when they send him back to the ship, the replica that they make with like three buttons and a spinner.
Yeah.
And like a weird rubber like body.
reminded me, is it Return to Tomorrow? Is that the one that had very similar sort of vessels?
Yeah,
that,
the Sargon androids, So although those ones were like way more hideous.
Frightening. How come there hasn't been Sargon cosplay at any of the conventions we go to?
I have no idea. Yeah, that episode, Return to Tomorrow, really establishes that androids can become really hideous bodies.
Yeah.
Which you don't see anywhere else. But yeah, like I like the process of creating the Kirk clone. I think the solution to how Kirk manages to trick the android into giving itself away would be rewritten very heavily nowadays.
Yes.
But I like the idea that it's the behavior patterns that, once again, are not able to be carried through by the android.
Okay, well, why don't we jump over to iMud? Because this one, we went into a little bit more depth on it a few weeks back with our Harry Mudd episode. But this one does kind of show like a evolution of the androids that we first met and what little girls are made of here. How do you find their portrayal? Like, is it showing kind of the Star Trek writers playing around with sort of the ideas that were introduced a season earlier? It keeps going back to the whole women are property sort of deal, which we find disturbing. But is there anything of interest to you that jumped out?
Yeah, I mean, they do come across a lot as like fembots, like from the Austin Powers franchise.
Yeah.
A similar idea in the 60s. But I think actually their aim is interesting, the idea that they want humanity to rely on them and ultimately take them over, because humans will just so easily just rely on the androids to do everything for them that at a certain point they'll just become weakened. And I think that's an interesting sci-fi idea and one that makes a lot of sense.
Well, one of the things that they have in common, though, and I think we can get into it further down the road, though, is but these aren't androids necessarily created by humans.
No.
Like, we found that with both these two episodes here, they're from either faraway times or faraway distances. And so it's still kind of applicable to kind of the human journey. It's interesting, but I think, you know, further into our discussion, we can get into kind of the human factor and what it means for a human to try to create something in their own image, you know, much like that God issue.
Right.
I mean, look, this was a lighter episode than Harry Mudd's first one.
Sure.
You know, I think you can have some fun with Norman, that initial android.
I think Norman's awesome.
Yeah.
I had kind of forgotten about Norman. And when we did our revisit of iMud for the Harry Mudd episode we did a couple weeks ago, I was like, oh my God, how did I forget Norman? This character is awesome.
Yeah.
And I love that, once again, it's a fun, creative way to solve the problem of let's confuse these androids. It's very goofy, you know, nowadays, but I do like the idea of trying to disrupt their logic sensors, basically.
Yeah. I do that to you every week on the show.
It works constantly.
Cannot compute.
You're like, I hate you. I love you. My head just explodes.
Cam, let's jump over to season 3 with one of your favorite episodes, Requiem for Methuselah.
Now, Tyler, you had never seen this episode before, had you?
No.
Yeah, I think I've seen it like 4 times now.
Wow. just a bit of a spoiler for everyone out there, but essentially we're introduced to a human. We find out this is inexplicably perhaps the most advanced immortal life that Earth has ever produced.
And yeah.
He is essentially Sebastian Bach as well.
Brahms.
As I think Da Vinci.
Yeah,
as
Da Vinci.
Well.
Solomon.
We mean this literally. This is a great genius man who has been alive for about 5,000 years, who cannot be killed, and he keeps on changing his identity. And so all these classic inventors and artists that we've known throughout the ages, this is actually him this entire time, and he just keeps changing his identity.
Yeah.
He's gotten to the point where he can keep doing stuff and inventing more sex bots.
Yeah, he's made several attempts. We see he's got Reyna is the name of the android in this one. And Reyna's a character that I find really interesting because she's brought out, and at least when we first meet her, she's just someone who, kind of like a Data, has a real thirst for knowledge. And the idea of meeting Kirk and crew, they're there to get some drug to save their crew members who have a disease. And I like the idea that she's there for an exchange of ideas. Like, that's what really drives her, is to talk to Spock about science and things like that. Ultimately, none of that happens, at least on screen. And it becomes more of this Flint character, and Flint is this Brahms, etc., immortal being, essentially.
There's not as much pageantry in the name Flint as there is in like Brahms or
kidding. Like Trelane had way more pageantry to that name.
Yeah,
you know, but and it's a, you know, similar kind of setup. But anyways, basically, Flint has created this female android, and he wants to teach her about love, and he thinks that Kirk could reawaken these emotions in her.
Well, some emotions are certainly reawakened in Kirk. Is this the actual Captain Kirk, as we know, who falls madly in love with this woman that he intellectually knows is a robot?
He doesn't initially. He finds out a little bit through, but he's still gung-ho even after he finds out.
Yeah, but it's not really kind of the Captain Kirk that we know best of all, though. This is just, it seems as if it's William Shatner playing almost like a different character at this point. Like, I just don't understand how he can be so enraptured by, just this woman that he knows for 2 hours?
If that. Although they said, Flint said, you can come for a few hours. I feel like it was maybe only an hour. They danced, and that was about it.
Yeah, and so he falls in love with this robot. Does she somehow have, like, kind of these abilities?
Does it not feel like they cut a line about pheromones or some sort of hypnotic quality or something? Kirk acts really bizarre throughout this entire episode, to the point where like Spock and McCoy are actively just like looking at him like he's nuts.
So what does this mean for kind of the development of androids? This is the first time we actually see a human built android, and again we find out, you know, what it comes down is the desire for a woman to be a physical object, even though this one seems to have far more sentience and far more agency than any other android that we've encountered to the point. But it goes without saying that, what does she decide her fate to be, Cam, at the end?
Well, she's got to choose between these two dueling jackasses who are having this bizarro fight. That just reminds me, my mom always has a saying she drops. It's, I think, a well-known saying, but there's no fool like an old fool. And there is no bigger old fools than watching Flint and Kirk scuffle around on the floor for the love of Raina. It's embarrassing.
But essentially, she decides to terminate her own programming
because
she can't choose
between the two.
Yeah, so it's again like this is the role of a woman. And it's just like, oh God, like, come on, guys.
But as an evolution, Raina is definitely the first, I think, of the she feels like a real character, with her own sort of objectives and what she wants, which I would not have said really for the others. I mean, I guess you could maybe say Corby, but it's very difficult to know how much of that is just the previous Corby's programming versus Corby robot himself making these decisions versus Raina actively wants something and then is disrupted with her programming because she can't choose between these two, this benefactor and then Kirk.
Well,
so, like, I think it's interesting. This episode is terrible in a lot of ways, but, like, I can appreciate what character is trying to do.
From the pure android level, we do get more of the sense of sentience and agency. And I do appreciate that. And this is kind of the first human-built android that we get to talk about here.
Flint is human, but he is an immortal as well. And a lot of this is about, like, the curse of immortality. But I mean, in the original series, we never see an android made by just really a normal human being.
And I think that's actually a good distinction that you bring up in that he is an immortal man, which kind of makes him almost kind of a very literal god.
He's got thousands of years of life to, you know, harness his knowledge and increase it.
He seems pretty miserable, though, doesn't he?
Well, that's the curse of immortality.
Yeah. So why don't we skip ahead? We'll get to the goods here. What I'm going to do right now is lay my head on my desk, much like Kirk did at the end of this episode, and begin sobbing as I think about the prospect of ever having to rewatch this one.
Forget.
Yeah.
Although we should touch also in talking about original series era, the Ilya probe showing up in the motion picture, which is kind of the last of the original series crew touching on these sorts of themes. We don't get a lot of Ilya, but it is, you know, V'ger, once again, supreme intelligence. It's not a human being making this android, but we do see at the end, like, that this transference that's gone on, similar to the Corby one, where the original Ilya, the Delton character's personality is wound up in this probe, we see the emotions coming through, or at least the programmed emotions of Ilya at the end. So it really does show that, like, Star Trek is fascinated with the idea of these androids tackling emotion and whether they can ever truly get it. And I guess Ilya is a little bit of a further progression from where Raina and, you know, Andrea were.
I just still think that somebody like Commander Decker is kind of a dork for like falling for an artificial facsimile of somebody that he loved. You know,
yeah.
It's not the same thing. I know it's maybe the next closest thing, but I don't know. Maybe he just really wanted to be part of the Human Adventure Camp.
Boy, did he.
Okay, so let's jump over to what I think everybody wants to get into, though, is the introduction of Data. And maybe let's kick it off with our own kind of experiences initially, like Data as a character, maybe what the appeal was to you. But I remember him, you know, he was one of the most iconic characters. Like, he was just out there in pop culture. And for me, kind of the appeal was, and it seems so obvious, but like kind of that childlike quality.
Right.
Where
Pinocchio.
But, and we do address this in an episode like The Offspring, which we'll go into a little later on, though. But like, for me as a kid, it was more like the laugh at, not necessarily laugh with aspect of Data that mm-hmm. I enjoyed. But as you get older, you kind of appreciate the layers that they're actually putting onto this character. But he just seems so innocuous and appealing in a way. But Brent Spiner, if it was anyone else, I don't know if you would have been able to sell this as a charismatic entity the way that Data presents himself.
Imagine another actor having to do that sneezing scene.
Or growing a beard.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, for me, when I was sort of loosely aware of TNG, I knew it was on the air, and like, you know, I would eventually go on and watch handfuls of episodes, but what grabbed me initially were Geordi and Data. And I think it's because they have the most kind of sci-fi look to them.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, I was a Star Wars kid growing up. And so the idea that, oh, this character is an android, it's like, oh, well, I mean, C-3PO, R2-D2, I love these, you know, robots in Star Wars, or even Darth Vader, who has, you know, kind of robot-like look to him. And Data was that as well. And I really liked the character when I was first watching episodes too. Like, I always liked the Data episodes because he was a character that had like a real hook that was easily digestible to me as a kid. If you give me a Riker episode as a kid, it was less appealing. I had no ability to relate to this towering alpha male with the swagger. I'm just like, okay, I guess. But whereas like Data, even though I am not an android, at least not most days, I could watch Data on screen and understand exactly who this character was and what his journey was.
It's just an easy kind of sci-fi hook to draw people in.
But and I can totally get why kids like him.
Well, let me ask you this, though. We've had all these years pass us by, though. Who do you like more as a character, though, like Data or Riker at this point?
I think as an adult, I am far more amused by Riker. Like, that's kind of what I love about Star Trek characters in general, the ones that I get drawn into their stories for sure, but they kind of amuse me on some way. Like, you can have in-jokes about the characters, or they have these quirky, you know, behaviors to them. And Riker has more of those to me that interest me. Like, Data's are more broad and definitely feel more pitched to kind of being the fan favorite character. Whereas I feel like Riker's kind of the cool character, like, because so much of his oddness is a little subdued. You got to dig for it.
Well, I would just say that, look, Data had a lot of great standout episodes, but I think Riker and Jonathan Frakes just had way more screen time if you add it all together. And I think he actually had more depth to that character. And at a certain point, maybe Data hits a ceiling to a certain degree until you get that emotion chip in Star Trek Generations.
Yeah.
And you're going down a certain path. But with Riker, though, you see where he starts in season one, where he's this kind of, he's a little bit more of an uptight by the book sort of guy. I'm not saying he's not uptight or by the book by the end of it, but you do see him loosen up to a certain degree. And Frakes also gets to play the role a lot looser than Brent Spiner gets to do.
Oh, totally.
And those men are both charisma bombs right there. So I think Riker can just draw me in. And honestly, it's a lot of stuff that I can relate to more, you know, whether it's just, you know, decisions about relationships or careers or just kind of duty to those in your lives. And so I relate more to the Riker thing more than the Data thing.
Don't you think Riker's an odd character, though? That's kind of what makes him so fascinating.
Yeah, even just stuff like him interacting with Jellicoe, you know, like that is like some of the most interesting stuff you get to see Riker do. Because
the trombone scenes as well, or when he's giving love advice. Like, I think it's very telling that it feels like in recent years, it's Jonathan Frakes memes that are becoming really popular when it comes to TNG.
Oh, yeah. Is it just because they lend themselves so well to some of the silliness versus like the data stuff might seem a little bit obvious. Like,
yeah, I think that's what it is. It is obvious. Like the data stuff when you first see those episodes is like hilarious or awesome or whatever, whatever emotion they're going for.
Yeah.
But it's right on the face of it. Whereas the Riker stuff, you kind of got to peel back a layer sometimes and just really reflect on who this character is as a human being.
But all that said, I think Star Trek fans at large are probably bigger Data fans.
I agree.
Just if we had to take a poll on that, and maybe let's dig into the reason why. When he's introduced in Encounter at Farpoint, they literally say the words Pinocchio on screen. And you definitely say that there's a difference between the character in season one versus season seven, though. And I think it has to do with his time spent aboard with this crew, a crew that took an immediate, I wouldn't say liking to him, but had an immediate investment in him. And, well, maybe Tasha Yar took an immediate liking to him as well.
Yeah, and what I think is really genius with Data is that with Spock, you had this, tug of war going on with humanity and Spock. Like, he would kind of sometimes feel like he was being left out of human emotions or behaviors, but he was always pulling back to the Vulcan side. Like, he was much more reserved and would usually default back to kind of a stiffer Vulcan reserve. Whereas, like, Data is a character who is like Spock and other character, but wants to understand humanity and has an enthusiasm for it.
Yeah.
So you can have fun in a different way with this other character. With Spock, the fun is how, you know, you get the comedy between him and McCoy about how Spock won't give in to humanity. Whereas, like, Data, you get the humor of him embracing humanity and how it can come across as kind of goofy sometimes.
But it's interesting to see kind of the tragedy of the character, because you know that he can never accomplish his goal. Whereas for Spock, if he wanted to embrace humanity, he was fully capable of doing so. He just didn't want to.
And it's an internal thing for Spock.
Yeah.
Whereas Data, it's more
very external. Yeah.
Or I guess internal with his wiring.
Yeah, fair enough.
But what makes Data also interesting is he's the first android we see in Star Trek with a positronic brain, which is developed by Noonien Soong, which essentially establishes right out of the gate on TNG that this is a character who is more advanced than any android we've seen, which I think opens the door for a lot of different types of stories than they would have been able to do in the original series.
Well, let's kick it off with, I think, one of the most significant Data stories early on, which was Data Lore. And Cam and I, you and I talked about this off air, but if this is considered one of the high points of like season one
and
Star Trek, and it is, wow, did we have low standards back in the day. There's a lot of great stuff in this. But there's a whole lot of bad stuff, like just with the whole shut up Wesley instances.
Is that bad, though?
it comes off as very clumsy, and it seems as if it's from an entirely different TV series at this point. But there's even stuff like Data finding out he has a brother, and then Geordi turning to the camera and saying, "Brother, I like the sound of that." And I'm like, oh, wow, racism. That's hilarious. It's just like a lot of cringeworthy moments. But look, there's some intriguing stuff. Argyle gets a big showcase to assemble Lore's body when it's introduced.
The first 25 minutes of this, I think, is actually really strong.
Sure.
That's where all the good stuff is.
Yeah.
And where they find Lore and we, you know, get to meet this version of an android who has an emotional response to people. Like, he's not, you know, he says he's the more developed Data.
Because he's lying at this point.
Yes.
He's saying that I actually came after Data. I'm the more advanced version of this particular model. So,
Right. Yeah, so
it is interesting that we have kind of this development, the evolution of an android right there. You start with Lore, you end up with Data, which is considered the more advanced one, but it is one that is not quite capable of being quite as human as Lore. Like, who seems like the more human character, you know, like Lore or Data? It's Lore.
Because Lore may be a somewhat malevolent, often evil character, but that is also more human than what Data would be able to do.
But let's talk about their motivations as well, because like Data, we understand what his motivation is. It is to strive to be more human. Whereas Lore, it's, I would say malevolence, but it's almost a kind of this jealousy and revenge and resentment towards humanity that drives him. And I honestly wonder what his ultimate plan is with the crystalline entity, which they often refer to as the crystal thing in this episode, which is like funny.
Yeah. But like, the crystalline entity is such a weird creation for that series.
I'm pretty sure it's coming back in Star Trek Picard.
Oh, I would be amazed.
Cannot wait.
Yeah.
But it's him on a path of destruction, which, you know,
right.
Look, I just think it was genius, and maybe it seemed like super obvious, but of course, if it's going to be a story about kind of brothers, sibling rivalry, get Brent Spiner to play against himself and get Brent Spiner to, you know, loosen up in this role, like really go for it and just kind of have a moment after moment of showcase for him here.
How much of it is that Lore is a spoiled like child throwing tantrums, you know, where he's not necessarily thinking things through? It's more like he's constantly angry because Data's obviously the favorite son.
So he's like the oldest child who suddenly introduced to the newborn sibling that comes home from the hospital, and now he has to share all his toys.
Yeah, like, does Lore strike you as having emotional intelligence?
No, he's kind of Armus level to a certain degree, you know.
Yeah.
So, but look, it's fascinating. And what do you make of maybe Wesley having a certain intuition about something being wrong here, with Wesley being the one able to recognize it and everybody just like pounding him down for that, even floating such an
idea? Well, I mean, this is season one. These are the days of Wesley has to save the ship by the end.
Yeah.
I mean, I do like that really clunky bit where he's like, if you'd spoken in contractions, I might have been suspicious of you.
Yes. What about like the nervous twitch? Like that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
Like, okay.
I mean, I guess they had to give some sort of visual signifier to indicate that Lore was Lore, especially when you're switching uniforms. That one's a little hammy.
Yeah, I just wish they gave him like a goatee or something. That would have been
kind of fun. Or maybe a little more of a subtle poker tell, something that took a little bit of observation. Because honestly, I think this episode looks terrible for Picard and crew.
Oh,
like they look
they
inept.
Look dumb.
Yes.
Yes.
Actively dumb.
So, hey, maybe it's just showing why androids are superior beings to humans at this point.
Yeah.
Let's jump forward, though, Cam. This is, I would say, a far stronger entry here, but Brothers, and we have the return of Lore, which I think is very important. But I think even more important, though, it's the creator meeting his creation. I think we're being shown this story through the eyes of Data, who actually loses his agency throughout this episode. And because, of course, his programming takes over, and he takes over the ship and brings it over to where Soong is now hanging out on this planet as he kind of prepares for his twilight years here.
Twilight years. He's playing baseball covered in sparkles.
Okay, Cam, I need to ask you this. How old is Noonien Soong supposed to be?
Oh, boy. It's very tough to say. I'm going to guess he's in a similar age group as McCoy in Encounter at Farpoint. He has a similar...
Give me a year.
So, like, 140?
140. Okay. I was
somewhere
just curious.
In that.
I'm gonna come back to this question in a few moments here.
Okay.
But I just wanted to get to you on record, 140-ish. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, cool.
I'm sure Memory Alpha could answer this for me, but I'm just going to go with 140 at the moment.
Well, maybe. So yeah, let's go back to this one. Mm-hmm. And like, I find this kind of an intriguing concept, well-executed, and goes back to the whole...
Well, it does much more with the idea of these creations and the creator than Data Lore did. Like, we learn more about Lore as a character through this episode. Like, it feels just more rich and layered.
What do you make of Soong as kind of a creator? This seems like to be kind of a messed up dude.
Soong is a weird character.
Yeah, and you wonder if this is a guy who's the most advanced at developing androids, should he really be the one in charge of all this, like creating kind of the next development in, not humanity, but the next development in what humans are capable of, though? Like, it just seems as if he's not quite with it.
Although, isn't that the case for any, like, great, great, ahead-of-their-time genius, in that you are disconnected from humanity to a certain degree? It's just that you have the intelligence and the ability to create these things that no one else would.
So I think maybe the colonists maybe had a point when they were trying to rise up against Soong many a time.
Yeah, like, I mean, I have no doubt he was an odd guy. It makes a lot of sense. I mean, the guy who's spending his entire life obsessively trying to master the positronic brain, probably not Mr. You know, go down and hang out with the guys and go bowling on Saturday nights or something.
I'd love to watch Star Trek bowling. that's quite amazing.
And I think what adds to this whole thing with Soong too is that, like, because they wanted Brent Spiner playing him and they want to disguise that it's Brent Spiner, he gets this very elaborate makeup job. He gets a very odd voice. Like, they have to make him more eccentric and odd-looking to hide the fact, or at least to create a distance between Data and the body language and voice of Data versus Dr. Soong. But it makes Dr. Soong become weirder and weirder and weirder.
Yeah, I'll admit, when I first watched this one, you know, 25 years ago, I had no idea that it was Brent Spiner playing Dr. Stone at the time. So, like, it fooled a very dim-witted child like me. So,
right.
Probably took me until, like, a year ago to figure out that it was Brent Spiner. That's how slow I am.
Right. Here.
But what do you think this tells us or informs us about kind of the journey of or the evolution of androids up to this point when you have the return of Lore and they do have kind of this fight over the emotion chip, though, where Soong explains to Lore, you were never meant to have this. Your systems just aren't advanced enough. Like, I think that is even more drive for Lore moving forward with his own motivations against Data and his resentment towards his baby brother.
It also says something, too, about just the fact that as a creator, your creations are going to take on a life of their own. And ultimately, you kind of get the split sides of that, where Lore ultimately is the cause of his death versus, you know, Data is the one who's going to carry more of the optimism and good intentions of Soong going forward. It's very much this yin and yang with his creations.
Well, okay, so we've got the sibling rivalry covered. We have the creation meets creator thing covered. Why don't we talk about, like, Android trying to become a parent at this point, where we have a standout episode like The Offspring, in which Data is able to come across some technology, figure out some of the problems with the positronic brain that he couldn't figure out before. We get Lol here, and this is such a strong entry with regards to Data, who I don't know if he's kind of he's still striving to become human. Is he in the best position to raise a kid? Guess what? Ask any new parent. Nobody feels as if like they know what they're doing. Nobody feels qualified. Yeah. So this is why I think this is such a genius episode. And I think Data, he can't have emotions, but man, you know he is invested as hell in what Lol's development is going to be.
Yeah, this feels very much like a spiritual sequel to The Measure of a Man.
Yes.
Where we had Data really owning his own individuality and rights to exist as a citizen without being, you know, a lab study project.
Well, maybe let's briefly touch on Measure of a Man, though.
Sure.
Because, like, one of the things that I think is a standout performance from Patrick Stewart with one of his first great speeches here, but how much do you kind of buy the argument that's being made? Or what's the fundamental thing at stake here? It's like, is an android sentient? Do you think Data, there's something special about Data that makes him more sentient than, say, I don't know, like a Norman that we meet in iMUD?
I think there is that spark. And I mean, I think it does tie back to the positronic brain.
Yeah.
You know, they'll constantly reference back. That's what makes him special. And so, yeah, I think both him and Lore have achieved this higher standard of being. I think the question is, maybe if you're looking at the original series, like, was Reyna approaching that? Like, maybe that one's who's kind of right on the precipice of being able to enter that kind of arena. But at this point in time, I think Data and Lore are both individuals who should have their own rights. And I think the show does actually a really good job of establishing that, especially in season two, where the show is off the rails. You know, they could have easily fumbled this episode, but I think it's a really great episode.
And that one, it's worth noting, though, here, we're talking about, like, what is property? And Data is declared to be Starfleet property. Is that true? I don't know if this is intentional. Maybe I'm just reading too much into it. Melinda Snodgrass wrote this one. You look at all the Android episodes where it's in TOS, it's all about, you know, female androids being the property of these male creators to a certain degree. She's flipping it on its side there. She's saying, well, I don't know, does it work if it's kind of this man who's now property, you know?
Right.
So I think that's just kind of an intriguing idea that she's at least floating out there.
Definitely. I would have been interested to look at some of these themes a little later down the road when you have an episode like Brothers where Data takes over the ship single-handedly.
Yeah.
Like, there has to be someone at Starfleet that's like, oh boy, this is a safety risk.
Well, and they do address this quite a bit in The Offspring. How did the admiral in this one not make our list of Starfleet admirals who suck, Cam?
Like, he does suck.
He is one of the suckiest admirals we've ever encountered.
He does. I kind of give him a little bit of, just a smidgen of extra credit, just for at the end where he really does come around. But yeah, for the whole episode, he is totally a boo-hiss character.
But it's intriguing, though. This is a great one for, you know, Picard's own journey, because Picard is kind of disturbed that Data goes ahead and creates an advanced android, one as advanced as Data, without consulting anybody. Do you think Picard does have a point, though? Because Data says, well, other people don't need to consult you about their plans on procreation. Is it really an accurate analog that Data's trying to posit here, though? I think Picard does have a point.
I think where Picard has an argument is that this is, in many ways, an experimental, you know, creation. And so how could that impact the ship? And so I can understand why, from the point of view of being the captain, you go, this could be a potential problem. Whereas I don't know that you would say that if, just for example, say Riker and Troy were like, we're going to have a child.
Yeah.
You know, that's not going to maybe pose a security risk that maybe an experimental life form that maybe doesn't go according to plan could impose on the ship.
And then it's interesting when you hear the Admiral's argument, though. It's like, no, we can't have them together because what if, you know, there's a Romulan attack and we lose two of the most advanced androids? Let's separate them. And I don't think that's
that really... argument I'm less won over by.
Yeah, I think what he really wants to do is get Lal into his old hands and make sure that she comes out the way that he would like. Like, he wants to take full responsibility over the development and not rely on Data, who, as we kind of talked about, he's still the one kind of developing into humanity. Maybe there's some wrong lessons, especially when he points out that she's working as a cocktail waitress in Denport, which still fun to watch that, though. Like, I'm like, yes, it's a perfect time for human interaction algorithms to kick in.
It's interesting that this admiral who wants to have some sort of ownership over Lal is very much portrayed as the villain, whereas when you see in the original series, the, you know, say Flint with Reyna isn't necessarily portrayed as like a boo-hiss character. And you see it's just that shift of, you know, 30 years later in storytelling.
Yeah. Very briefly, look, Data pursues a relationship in theory, though.
Patrick Stewart's favorite episode.
Was this a directorial debut?
I believe it was. Yeah. They had a, I think it was DVD. I don't think it was, it was DVD set, and it was like the captain's favorites.
Okay.
And it had each captain pick their favorite episode, and they were all on this DVD set, and that was Patrick Stewart's. It was kind of an odd collection, though, because it was like, you know, Shatner and Brooks picking like Far Beyond the Stars, and Shatner, I think it was City on the Edge of Forever. So it's very much like the classic episodes that everyone thinks of when they think of Star Trek.
Yeah.
But anyways, Patrick Stewart's pick was In Theory, which looked really weird on the box set.
It's a solid one, though.
It is.
Him essentially getting into a relationship with a woman who wants an unavailable man, essentially. Sure. And it does show the limits of how his programming can take him and how kind of disappointing it can be for those around him. Even though we know the main crew, the fellow senior officers, I think they appreciate their relationship with him in a way that's, I don't know, is he capable of actually having a romantic relationship, Cam? Or is this just kind of, hey, like, first relationships never work out anyway?
I don't know. Yeah. Like, there's an episode, I can't remember which episode it is. It's in either the tail end of season 3 or early season 4, where Data is talking to Troy and he says, you know, I'd like to be a father at some point. And this isn't Offspring, this is another episode. And like, or sorry, not about being a father. It's the episode where Keiko and O'Brien get married. And Data says he would like to get married one day. And Troy has this moment of like, oh, no, Data, yeah, you would be great.
Right.
And so it does lead me to question whether that's a reality, like, or at least who would be able to relate to Data in a marriage situation.
I'll tell you, another android.
Yeah, that makes total sense,
The missing episode from TNG's, you know, android anthology, though, was essentially Data creates a partner.
Right.
Which, again, I think is potentially problematic in that we talk so much about like all these sex bots in the original series. I think there's potential for a really good story here, but it still makes me kind of cringe to a certain degree where if it's Data creating a partner, it's going to be to his specifications. And again, is it, let's be honest, if it's the 1990s, it's going to be like a heteronormative partner, right?
Right.
Data's pursuing that. And it just brings up a lot of these, like, it's a can of worms. I'm glad they didn't have to open up at the time, but I think that would have been the kind of the next most obvious journey for this character to pursue after In Theory. But, I mean, do you really want to go back to that In Theory? Well, like, are you going to be able to top it? Maybe, but more of a chance that you're not going to at that point.
Yeah, unless they went more of a tragic route, like Bride of Frankenstein type of idea.
I just say play it for pure comedy. Make it a B story. Make it pure comedy.
Right.
Geordi and Data build a bride. I don't know. That just sounds...
I don't want Geordi's input on this. I feel like that is a very questionable route.
We're laughing at this, but I believe that there's far more problems inherent in this idea then.
Sure.
Data, we get to the movie era, his character is all over the place. This is just, did any of the movies feel like the Data as we know him to you, Cam?
No, because, well, they went really down the emotion ship route, which I never really liked the emotion ship stuff. I totally understand its importance. You know, I can understand why they wanted to go there, because it makes a lot of sense with the evolution of this character. It's just that it was never portrayed in a way that I found compelling or well done.
You don't like Mr. Tricorder?
No, I don't. And, oh, just...
I guess I better stop talking to you that way throughout the entire podcast.
I think the problem is, too, like, I think Brent Spiner is a great actor, but it feels like a lot of the emotion ship stuff was just play it big, play big. And that doesn't really sell for me. Like, I would like if he had a little more nuance to him. It was more about Data dealing with emotional truth versus I can make wacky jokes and get scared.
I mean, I think the best that we got it, though, is in Star Trek First Contact, where Data now has the ability to turn it on and off, which I think is a cheat. It's 100% a cheat, but they do play around with that, with the Borg Queen being able to activate that. Sure. And we even do find out that for a split second, he was tempted by her offer, you know, so it is introducing more layers to him. Then we just have kind of retrograde Data in Insurrection, where his programming goes kablooey and he falls back on, I don't know what, just like infantile sort of programming, and he makes a friend in Hay.
Yeah.
It's like...
That's how you and I met.
It is a big coincidence, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that when you get to the movies, the audience, you know, the general audience going to those movies doesn't have the understanding of seven seasons of Data that we have.
Yeah.
And so it's like, how do we sell whatever Data's journey is in this movie in like bite-sized chunks that completely take out any of the nuance of, say, the emotion ship in Generations, where it's like, play it broad for an audience that doesn't understand this. They don't really want to see Data grappling with like a subtle relationship or something like that. They want to see wacky stuff. At least that's how I think the studio looks at it.
So then we also have the introduction of B4, and I just think, I get why they don't want to have to reintroduce lore. It's going to be a lot of exposition to dump on people, but I just don't think it's a very interesting sort of story to tell here, because what is the analog, though? We've already done the sibling thing before. We've already done the child story before.
We also have the mother in the season 7 episode Inheritance
as right.
well.
Yeah, the Juliana O'Donnell stuff, who I should mention, Fiona Flanagan, she played the mother to Brent Spiner in this. Do you know what other Star Trek actor she played mother to in an entirely different franchise?
Take a
wild guess.
I have no clue.
Okay. One, Jason Isaacs in the Showtime television series Brotherhood.
Oh, okay, okay.
They were both fantastic on that show, by the way. Okay. Yeah, but I thought this was a very intriguing one. Kim, what was the way that, I think we went back and forth via text message, and what was kind of the term that you used to push me in the direction of rewatching this one?
Yeah, because I can't say this is an episode that jumps to the forefront of everyone's mind when you talk about android stories on Star Trek.
Yeah.
But what I find fascinating about this character is that she is the first android who really is able to come across as entirely human to every human character in this story. Like, she has bridged the uncanny valley completely. Yeah. It's only Data that's picking up on the types of rhythms that no human being would ever be able to process. And that's, you know, her blinking and her ability to play music in sync, to do it basically the exact same way twice.
So we do get a holographic message from one Noonien Soong in this one. And this is why I go back to the age question, Cam.
Yeah.
So how old is Noonien Soong supposed to be in this hologram that he delivers to Data?
Maybe like 80? 90? I don't know.
90?
I don't know.
No, take a guess. So how old does he look, though?
Well, okay, here's what's weird. Like, if you ask me...
I'm just asking, how old does he look?
No, the thing is, though, like, when I look at the way Brent Spiner's made up, I go, like, I don't know, late 50s, early 60s? But he also has, like, skin grafts on his face that also make me go, he's far older than that.
Well, you mean,
I guess that's the reason.
You mean Brent Spiner has it, not Noonien Soong.
Well, Noonien Soong, exactly. The makeup, I should say, on Noonien Soong, on his face, there's like patches of it that look very...
He looks like he's playing about 60.
He looks 60, but with like some sort of Because when we say anyways,
what I'm getting at, though, is like you say 140 before, now you say 60. We're talking about an 80-year time difference.
Maybe he just looks really good for his age at this point.
I'm just saying it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't line up at all with regards to how much time was has passed between the creation of Data and the more advanced Juliana model. It makes absolutely no sense. And it's as if, you know, Nguyen Sung goes from 60 to 140 in the, 20, 25 years?
Sure.
Because we know that Data was activated about 27 years prior to season one of TNG. So just what I'm getting at, the timing doesn't line up. But it's but beyond that, what do you make of the decision that Data has to make about whether or not to tell Juliana that she is an android after she recovers from that android injury, though? Like, should he tell her or should he not? Or if you were an android, would you want to know?
I think Data makes the right choice for that character's journey, because with Data, it's the entire idea of he doesn't really have anyone. You know, Lal didn't work out, right? Like, she fell apart, essentially. Lore, he's never able to connect with. And so it makes sense to me that, you know, Data has to be somewhat isolated for his journey. And so it would be a little weird if suddenly we had Data's mom in the movies too. You know what I mean? Like, that's part of being a human, though, for Data, is letting her go.
They're tag teaming the operations console.
That's right, yeah.
Fiona Flanagan is action hero.
Taking down the Borg Queen.
Nice.
But no, just the idea that he has to make the very human decision to just let her go.
Let me ask you this. If you were an android and you didn't know it, would you want to know? And you thought you're human?
No, because I don't think I'm necessarily programmed to think about those sorts of things. I mean, maybe she is, because she is the most human android we've ever seen and is going to live a human life, essentially, and die of old age without knowing. So maybe she does have those sorts of curiosities, but I think it's better for her that she doesn't.
Well, I was just curious about you, though.
Would I want to know?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. No, I don't think so. If she's, you know, she's happily married, as we see.
No. I don't care about her.
Are you saying, like, in this exact moment?
No, just you personally. Let's say it's 2019. I don't know. Somebody has the ability to explain to you that you are an android.
No.
Cam Smith.
No, it would be very stressful.
All right, that's
very stressful.
All I was curious about that.
Right.
I'm just trying to get into your psyche. That's all.
What about you?
I was thinking about this after watching this. So, like, I thought it was an intriguing question. And I think it would probably be, like, devastating. Like, you know, like, it would be shattering to you. And what would I gain from this knowledge? Like, that's what I kept coming back to. I don't think I would gain anything, though.
You spend a lot of time trying to figure out who created you, even if any of your memories are true.
Well, speaking of who created you, so Juliana Tamor's husband had no idea that she was an android.
Right.
So presumably she was Dr. Nguyen Sung's sex bot as well.
Yes.
Okay. It's like, it keeps coming down to the sex bots.
Well, it's like his wife died, and so he created an exact replica that he was married to.
And she had tear ducts and even capillaries in skin, and I'm like, okay, there we go. Sung, if I didn't think you were a weirdo before, I think, seal the deal at this point.
Yeah.
So, anyways, we've kind of covered the spectrum of Data here. The B4 stuff, we didn't really get much out of that. And
I mean, did it feel unsatisfying because you are going so backwards? When you have this...
There's no new story to tell.
Well, when you have the Data's mom character, this is such an advanced android that's what's interesting, is the next evolution of where we're seeing these androids go. Is it really satisfying to go back to one that can't even process simple commands like holding a spoon? Like, what are we getting out of this? We were, you know, going way, 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 way back to the original series. Those androids were more advanced than this. And we were getting stories then that now feel a little outdated. Well, so, like, what do we get out of this?
No, dude, that's a knife. Take that out. Take that out of your mouth, Cam. Stop it. You're going to hurt yourself. Stop, Cam. Seriously. it just felt kind of like it was a pointless kind of story to tell. And I get what they're trying to do, but the thing is, they're going on well-trodden ground that they had done it better before throughout the course of Next Generation here.
Yeah. And what do we get out of it? Like, what is the big takeaway from B4?
It was a failsafe, though. It was essentially like, hey, Brent Spiner doesn't want to play this character, but just in case, we can have the character, we can have our cake and eat it too, to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And this is kind of the debate. Is it really B4 that we're seen in the Star Trek Picard trailers that we're seeing right now. Like, my guess is, I guess so, because, I mean, like, remember Picard literally pulls out, like, a Soong android body?
Yeah.
My guess is it's a dismantled before body, because maybe he couldn't really function with Data's memory engrams as they're programmed into it, and I don't know. We'll have to see whether the Brent Spiner that we're seeing is, in fact, before with Data's memories, or, I mean, you had posited it could be a holographic recreation of Data, but I think either way, before will be somehow showcased.
Somehow mentioned. I actually thought it was funny when I was just doing the research for this. There's always the memory beta stuff that shows up at the bottom of the page with some book tie-in or whatever.
My favorite.
I know, your favorite. But I just thought it was hilarious, genuinely hilarious, how there were several books that tackled before, and all of them featured him being dismantled. Like, there was not a single one that was like, now he's Data. You know what I mean? I think there was a comic recently, but like, it was just like years and years of books about how before had to be dismantled.
I can't disagree.
I love that. I mean, do you think it's an interesting question, because Picard is showing Data. I feel like androids have almost reached their end of the line in Star Trek. At least it feels like that in recent years, because I feel like when we had the holographic Doctor on Voyager.
You're reading my mind right now.
Yeah. It's like, okay, now we're going into the world of holograms and the evolution of holograms. And even like Discovery, it's a lot of cybernetics on people. You know, a lot of it is about the merging of flesh and machine.
The singularity.
Yeah, exactly. Is there room for androids? You know, we did get one, they say robot the whole episode, but, you know, and kind of android episode in Voyager with Prototype.
And I was thinking about that. I was just like, well, how come Voyager didn't go down to that? Well, this is a strong B'Elanna episode.
I really like Prototype a lot.
I do as well. But then, as you said, Cam, well, the reason why is because they're exploring the same issues with sentience and all that with holograms. I'm like, okay, well, I accept that. It makes sense. You are kind of, instead of going to, you know, well-trodden ground yet again, you are advancing this discussion and this debate even more. And I think maybe they even went into further depth about sentience, or even at least more frequently with the Doctor than they did with Data. So I'm all for that further inside the discussion. But is there room for more androids in the future of Star Trek? We kind of have, we know that Brent Spiner is going to be part of Star Trek Picard. We did see the short trek, The Escape Artist, featured from the Discovery universe with more Harry Mudd androids, which we both thought was hilarious fun.
Yeah, it's more of a throwback to those original series types of androids, though. Yeah.
Do you want to see more androids, or have we? Has it kind of run its course? Because can you really top the Data journey at this point? So what are you doing from here on out?
Yeah, well, there's also just the issue, too, of like, Star Trek is, with these android stories, it's all about a machine trying to become human, but now we've seen, like, the inverse of this with, like, things like the Borg, where it's about, you know, machine beings being brought back to humanity through Seven, you know? It's just like we've seen these types of stories done over and over. And so in Voyager, you get both the Seven stuff with the Borg, plus the Doc, the holodoc, and I don't know that there's a lot of room that at least I can think of, and I'm not that bright. So hopefully a Star Trek writer is sitting down right now to write a Brent Spiner episode of Picard that's really going to bring the next step of android storytelling. I just don't know what it is, because, you know, there's a moment in that Voyager episode where B'Elanna references Data and says, you know, he's the only one who has his own rights. He is just a citizen of the Federation, basically. So, like, where is there left to go if we're moving forward? If there are more androids like Data, well, they're just maybe just citizens of the Federation. Like, what makes them compelling stories to be telling other than, hey, they're members of the crew like all of us?
Which I think it's telling that Deep Space Nine never really wanted to go there. But Deep Space Nine always kind of stayed away from more of the, you know, high concept sci-fi stuff anyways, at least in the latter seasons. And then, you know, with say, Enterprise, maybe we had sort of the AI stuff. Remember Dead Stop with the space station, you know?
But you had Eric Soong showing up.
Which, maybe, here's what I'll posit to you, Cam.
Okay.
Maybe Eric Soong and Noonien Soong are the same person. Eric Soong was all into kind of eugenics and, you know, kind of expanding what humanity can do just through their own physical bodies. Maybe he waited long enough, got out of that jail cell, and he just kept extending his life. That's why we see him. He looks 140, but maybe he's, you know, more like 240 at this point. I don't know.
So the only thing is, with so much of like automation becoming a common factor in our current society, it does feel like android stories do feel like something that you would want to touch on if you're telling a sci-fi story that comments on the current era. I'm just really curious what that is, though, or if it is more just like, well, we kind of did all that. We were just ahead of the curve in the 90s and 2000s or whatever. So, like, do we really need to continue down that road, or do we want to look forward? I don't know.
I suspect that they can find a way, at least in the 24th, turning into the 25th century very soon, of kind of furthering that conversation. It'll be analogous to some of the Android stuff, but it's just tough to keep going back to that without repeating yourself in a way that isn't as good as what you had done, you know, maybe 25 years ago.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Cam, we're going to flash back to Las Vegas 2019. It is time for the annual Klingon Blood Wine Games. We have a fun one lined up, a lot of great contestants, and this is one of our favorite ones to go through every single year. It's just very lively, action fun. So if you're at home, you can actually kind of play along with the Klingon Blood Wine Games, and if you're not familiar with it, tune in. It is kind of unlike our typical episode to the nth degree. It's the biggest change up from any sort of episode that we typically do.
It's kind of our end of summer episode, very sure. much paving the way for the fall when we're, you know, looking forward to new Star Trek shows coming out and everything like that. We're wrapping up con season.
What new Star Trek shows are we looking forward to in the fall, Cam, this year? Yeah.
Just more coverage for Picard coming.
Exactly.
Okay. So you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vulcan Tummy Taster Smith.
You can find me at Reporton. That's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N. N as in Noonien Soong's wife, huh?
Hashtag too soon. Okay. So until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.